Chiara is going to open the discussion with a presentation on what IPEC has been.
Yes, it's my task to make you awake after the lunch break. So we issued our comment letter the 20th of June, where we agree with the approach taken by the board to split the issues into phases and to approach the pre-replacement issues initially. We agree with many of the proposals, but we have four, I would say, recommendations for the finalization of this exposure draft. The first is related to the retrospective assessment, where we think that a relief is needed also for including the uncertainties of IBOR reform in the retrospective assessment in IAS, in particular for IAS 39 assessment, because this complements the relief for prospective assessment. But this doesn't mean that the retrospective measurement of the ineffectiveness doesn't need that has to be still reflected in the account. The second point is about already clarifying in phase one what will happen when the relief ends to the effective share of the OCI reserve. And in particular, since all the relief is about granting the continuity of the hedge, these amounts should be reversed when the hedge transactions occurs in the future. So we think that this is important to be clarified already in the first phase. The third point is about the retrospective application. We agree with the retrospective application, but we disagree with not applying the amendments retrospectively to edges that were discontinued because entities were unable to apply the proposed relief. So in 2020, should an entity have discontinued an edge in 2019 because it was unable to apply the relief, we think in 2020 it should be possible to reinstate the effective the effects of the relief as if the relief was already available. And this has to relate with the timing issue, which I will approach in a while. Last point is about the disclosure, where we didn't see necessarily a good trade-off between the cost of the disclosure and the benefit, considering this specific first phase, which is about granting continuity. We felt that a qualitative disclosure around the impacts of the reform, the uncertainty created by the reform, and the extent of the use of the relief it would be more appropriate in this phase, and then leaving the quantitative disclosures for the next phase. Now, the most important message that I think I would like to give you for phase one is the urgency of finalizing these requirements. This is because we understand that entities need when they approve the results of 2019, they need to have already the endorsement completed. In particular, for European banks, it's the first half of February, the limit with the submission of the FINREP results. And we have discussed this also with the staff of the European Commission. We are convinced that the only way to meet the expectation is for the IASB to issue the standard in September, because otherwise the technical steps and the technical process is such that we could have a problem to finish by February. From our side, as EFRAG, the board has agreed last Tuesday to substantially shorten our comment period for the draft endorsement, draft advice, and to proceed with a written procedure of approval. This means that we will be able to react very, very quickly, but this is really not changing a lot the situation. And indeed, my question would be also to the other members whether they share the same time pressure. Moving to the second phase, we have included in the appendix of our letter a description of the different fact patterns that may exist for the different transitions, for the different benchmarks. And in particular, the word replacement may be not always appropriate. For example, for Euribor, there is no replacement. What is happening is a modification of the calculation methodologies behind the scenes, but there is no replacement. So it's important to understand the differences in the different fact patterns of the transition when you look at the issues of phase two. Same, for example, for Ionia, where there is a parallel between Ionia and Easter, like there will be a parallel for Sponia and LIBOR. But for Ionia and Easter, there is a clear economic relationship, thanks to the fixed spread between the two. So there will be a sort of assessment of continuity also in this period. So it's important to differentiate the implications of phase two, looking at the different fact patterns of the transition. In terms of topics for consideration in phase two, we have included in our appendix a list of items that were highlighted by our constituents. We didn't do a proper assessment or we didn't take a position on this. They are related mainly to the derecognition and demodification. In particular, this is relevant for loans where there is a bilateral agreement. The assessment of the derecognition, of course, is related to the reasoning I was doing before in terms of assessing legal continuity of the benchmark. Therefore, the recognition is important when there is a clear change and replacement in the benchmark. For the derecognition, the item is the concern of the constituents is whether operational relief could be granted from doing the assessment of derecognition and modification, because this could result in additional costs, only to demonstrate that at the end there are no changes. And for the modification gains and losses, the issue is whether where there is no derecognition and there is whether the one-off modification should result in P&L immediately or can be postponed to the future, so only to impact as a change in variable interest rate to the future instead of impacting P&L. So these were, as I said, we don't have a position. This is merely a list of issues that we have heard. In addition to this, there is the agent documentation and the recalibration of edge accounting in case of discontinuation.
So,
a couple of comments and then one question. That's right. So thanks for the update. That's helpful. I'm pleased that overall, EFREG seems pretty supportive of the exposure draft, which is good. A couple of observations. I think we're going to be doing everything we can to get the document finished as quickly as we can because we know the timing is really, really important. But I think in terms of expectations, even if everybody had written to us and said, we love the ED, just finalise it, I'm not sure we'd be able to get it done by September. And that's even if we approved everything in July and worked every day between July and publication. So we'll do it as quickly as we can, but I think September, just in terms of how anything you do with hedge accounting is, you know, every word matters as well. So we have to be careful.
Perhaps in exchange for a speedy endorsement of IFRS 17.
Moving right along.
Just a thought.
Thank you for that addition. Now I've forgotten what I was going to say.
You always could work a bit speedy.
We'll do it as quickly as we can. On the phase two, and then I'll come back to my question. On phase two, thank you for the list. I think it's pretty similar to the list that we had identified, which is always very comforting. I think one of the things that we're going to have to think about very carefully, and I think it's good that now we've got much more visibility about some of the differences that are going on with the rates in different jurisdictions, is how best to address it in a way that sort of can accommodate different things going on all over the place. And I think in particular that will be important with the modifications to try and come up with something that's, you know, will work everywhere. That probably needs to be a bit more principles-based, I think. One of the things I think we're also going to have to think about is, given what's happened in Europe, which is quite a subtle way that the rate change in rates has been dealt with, where the words have kept the same but the calculation methodology has changed, we're going to have to think carefully about that as well, because the modification requirements in our literature don't ask whether the contract has been modified. They ask if the contractual cash flows have been modified. And so I think there could be consequences because the calculations have changed, even though the words haven't changed. And we're going to have to think through carefully on that. And my question. So you're not the only ones who have raised the question, the request, that we think about whether or not we could do something with the retrospective application, particularly in the context of 39, so whether we could provide relief for the 8125 on the basis that all of the ineffectiveness still gets recognised, but you can at least still continue hedge accounting, which I think is what you're suggesting, which is consistent with some comments from others, which wasn't in the proposals. I wondered whether there was any discussion at EFRAG about how we might go about doing that, because I think the tricky thing for us is that, based on my understanding of the likely effects on the contracts, the IBOR reform in itself probably wouldn't cause a relationship to fall outside 80-125 unless there was already a relationship that had basis risk or some noise in it. So it might have already been a relationship that could have ended up quite close to 80-125 even without the IBOR effects. And one of the things I've been struggling with is, how do we know whether a hedge has busted 80-125 because of IBOR reform, or whether it would have busted 80-125 anyway, mm-hmm. and there's just a small incremental effect from IBOR? Because if we're not careful, we would have had a hedge that wouldn't have been allowed to continue hedge accounting anyway, because it already had lots of basis risk. And if we say just because there's also IBOR reform, we'll just assume it's a good hedge, we'd be sweeping in stuff that would otherwise have failed the relationship. And I just wondered whether there'd been any discussion on that at TEG.
The point was not about the quantitative impact, because I agree with you, it's very difficult to identify a principle under which you decouple the ineffectiveness, the true ineffectiveness, from the ineffectiveness coming from the reform. And we didn't go that direction. The idea here is simply to say, for the prospective assessment, for the highly likely criterion, you have given the relief for the prospective assessment. But for cash flow hedges, we need the same relief also for the retrospective, to pretend the cash flows will still happen as if the benchmark will continue to stay. So it's simply the relief from considering the uncertainties of the IBOR when doing the prospective retrospective. So it's, you pretend that it is still highly likely that you will have that that rate. It's not about the quantification of the ineffectiveness. That has to be, we agree with you, it has to be reflected.
I'm not sure I understand that, because highly probable isn't tested retrospectively.
No, I think it comes down to the point, if I understood correctly, that a lot of entities use the same method to calculate their prospective and retrospective effectiveness assessment. So, and when they then do their prospective assessments, we say, pretend that you've got 5-year LIBOR loan. Pretend that for the prospective assessment, you're still going to have this 5-year cash flows coming from LIBOR when you do your assessment as to whether it's going to be effective. And because they use the same method, when they calculate the fair value of the items to compare to what they've got on the hedging instruments, they look forward and they say, okay, what is the fair value based on the cash flows that I expect to give me the fair value of the asset today? And it's in adjusting or assessing those cash flows that they are saying, well, for the same reason, I need to assume that I'm still going to have five-year LIBOR cash flows coming in to determine the fair value of what I've got.
But that must be for the 8125 test, yeah? Because for the actual measurement, they're going to do the actual measurement, right?
Yeah.
So it is for the 8125 test. But when you do the test, you want the same assumption to apply.
Exactly. It's only that. But the measurement of the ineffectiveness, you still have to do it.
Right. It's understood.
I think I...
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Linda.
All right. So I have some materials that I would be happy to give you, but if I went through them all, that because my staff is very good at this, then we'd be here all night, so we're not going to do that. But so I basically want to comment on a couple of things. One is on the current state of play in Canada, and I can be fairly brief on some of what the ask is for phase two because it aligns quite nicely, I think. But so in terms of the current state of play in Canada, there's a lot of activity which is largely centered in the Bank of Canada, but also the prudential regulator, OSFI, the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, is also engaged. So right now, there is out for public comment a new methodology, which is called the Enhanced Canadian Overnight Repo Rate Average, otherwise known as Enhanced CORA, with two R's. So. And so that's out for public consultation now, and that consultation is still open. I don't have the date when it closes, but I think it's fairly soon. And so that is being discussed right now. But in the meantime, there's another rate, CDAR, Canadian Dollar Offered Rate, which is being used widely in terms of, in terms of the current needs. And the feeling is that the new rate, the Enhanced CORA, will ultimately move in over time and replace this other rate. And so there is also some talk about how they will do that transition. So that all leads into the discussion around, and so within that context, there's a couple of concerns. If it's going to be a Canadian-focused rate, we always deal with the notion of do we have enough liquidity, enough volume to support what is necessary, so that we'll have to deal with that. But also in the Canadian context, there's being set up a committee to oversee how the panel banks actually submit the rates. So there's a whole governance aspect being introduced, which I think makes a lot of sense given where we've been. And so that's kind of the state of play in Canada in terms of developments. But we are supportive of the exposure draft. We also have a time challenge. And as you know, all of our large banks in Canada have October 31st year end. So our time challenge is your time challenge minus 2 months. And we understand that. We understand that. So we're going to have to work through kind of the nuances of that. And we will do that within Canada, including having consultations with our audit firms. Suffice it to say, we're all under big time pressure. And we know that you're working as quickly as you can, but we just all have to keep that in mind. So we're supportive. And we'll do what we have to do. In terms of the phase two, the 80 to 125 discussion came up with our banks and Canada big time, but as well also with corporates. So there's a big concern there. So no difference in terms of what you're saying. The specific thing that they said was, whatever you do in transition, think about whether that's going to cause a DDES and a REDES, because the paperwork would be monumental. And as well, none of our banks have transitioned to IFRS 9 hedge accounting. They've all stayed with IAS 39. IAS 39 hedge accounting is alive and well, so it, you know, has to be dealt with there. Also some of the same comments about, you know, things that have gone into AOCI on transition, what are you going to do with those ultimately? And I think it's important to think about what you're going to do, because there's going to be the technical accountants who need the technical guidance, but there's also what kind of disclosures are you going to ask people to do ultimately after the relief ends so that the results are understandable. And saying that hedge accounting results are understandable, like, it's kind of an oxymoron, but we want to do the best we can to do that. And we also got some comments about, you know, the notion of modification versus derecognition and that sort of thing. So I'm happy to provide lots of detailed comments to the staff, but in general, like, a lot of alignment in terms of that. Now, my staff did just have another call 2 days ago with the banking industry, and so I'm kind of looking at this. and saying the one thing they're coming back with is they emphasize the need to understand the timing on the exposure draft, so they did emphasize that. They also said that they're starting to be concerned because they're global. They're seeing different reforms developing at different pace in different jurisdictions. So their concern is, while we need to get phase one done quickly, we think you need to also think about the timing of phase two because they're seeing different things happening. And so they also, in this latest discussion, brought up the notion of what the FASB might be doing. And is there going to be any discussions between the ISB and the FASB, or are we going to be dealing with different methodologies? So I'll bring that up right now. And we are typically the only jurisdiction who cites that, but I'll bring it up right now in terms of, you know, a desire to understand what's going to be happening between the two boards.
Any other vehicle?
I'm going to explain the comments from the AO SSG members on what topics should be considered on phase two. We received comments from four members. They are Australia, Hong Kong, Korea, and Malaysia. Three members noted there is an issue on derecognition or modification of assets and liabilities when the contracts are amended. For financial assets, if amendment is treated as derecognition, new financial assets would be recognized. Then we would have an issue on the staging of those financial assets within the impairment model. One member noted there is no clear guidance in IFRS 9 or IAS 39 on derecognition of modified financial assets, while IFRS 9 has guidance on financial liabilities. That member noted a similar issue was raised at the Interpretations Committee in 2015, and that member suggests we look at that discussion at that time. In addition, one member noted if amendment is treated as modification of a financial asset, the carrying amount should be recalculated, and modification gain or loss should be recognized. In calculating the carrying amount as the present value, IFRS 9 says it should be discounted using the original effective interest rate. The original rate was based on the original IBOR floating rate, so retaining the original rate may not provide useful information. For hedge accounting, three members noted an issue of whether hedge accounting is discontinued or not. They pointed out issues such as changes in hedge documentation, treatment of cash flow hedge reserve and fair value hedge adjustment, and the assessment of a hedging relationship. For the assessment issue, one member is concerned about retrospective assessment under IAS 39. In particular, when benchmark rate and replacement rate both exist, the assessment might be affected. Also, the assessment might be affected if replacement for the hedged item is done at a different timing from the replacement for the hedging instrument. That member hopes that the ISB could address the replacement issues soon, together with the finalization of phase one. That's the summary of the comments from AOSSG members.
Noble?
Yes, thank you. Regarding the issues for phase two, I think we're consistent with what Kiara and Linda were saying. And we also endorse Linda's comment about alignment with the treatment under U.S. GAAP. We are very concerned that if we have different treatment under IFRS and U.S. GAAP. The constituents have told us that they want any relief to be as generous as possible, whereas from a standard setter's perspective, I think we would like the ISB to be very careful in scoping the relief, because so that the relief does not relieve contracts that really shouldn't be relieved, and therefore we really want to monitor how you limit the scope of the transaction that should be relieved.
Okay. AO.
The AOSSG representative kindly mentioned about modification issue, so let me elaborate on the modification issue. As for the modification of financial liability, there is already specific guidance in IFRS 9, which requires the entity to re-recognize the original financial liability and recognize a new financial liability if the modification is substantial. Also, a modification is regarded as substantial when it exceeds a 10% threshold according to the application guidance of IFRS 9. In contrast, there is no explicit guidance in IFRS 9 on how to account for the modification of a financial asset. The IFRS Interpretations Committee attempted to address this issue in 2015 and consider whether to conduct a narrow scope project to provide relevant guidance. However, in May 2016, the Interpretations Committee decided not to take on a project to amend IFRS 9, citing significant time and resources requirement and its complexity, although it is admitted the importance of this issue. So as we are now preparing for accounting implications of the IBOR reform, we think that now is the time to review whether to maintain the May 2016 agenda decision by the Interpretations Committee. Thanks.
Marcia?
I thought I would share a little bit about what we are doing in the U.S. And some decisions that the FASB has made and what we are considering at a board meeting later this month. There have been some interest expressed in trying to understand where we are. First of all, I'd like to point out that in our existing hedging guidance, we did have a modification to one of our updates in 2017 that actually addresses what we call the change in hedged risk in a cash flow hedge. Thus, under existing literature today, an entity may be able to change its risk from a LIBOR stream cash flow to a different reference rate and continue the accounting as a hedge if the new rate is going to be highly effective on a prospective manner. We do know that if it's not going to be highly prospective, then there's going to be an interest in having some other transition guidance on what to do. And we've been working on this. In the U.S., you may be aware that we have a rate called SOFR. The Federal Reserve began actually publishing a SOFR rate in April of 2018, and in October of 18, we added SOFR as a benchmark interest rate for hedge accounting purposes. So that seems to be, while we realize some contracts may go to a different reference rate than SOFR, we are monitoring this new rate and the governance around that as we go through our process. We had a meeting in the middle of June, and the FASB actually did reach some decisions around what would be the characteristics for some relief as it relates to transition from LIBOR. And first, I'd like to indicate what we're talking about the relief to be, and then I would indicate the scope that to which this would apply. First of all, we realize that there's a question about whether a change in the reference rate is a modification to a loan or a debt instrument, troubled debt restructuring modification, or an extinguishment. And we would like to provide relief that would say if the change is strictly in the reference rate, it is not necessarily any of those items. So there'd be no need to make an assessment as it relates to the contract. We also are taking a look at providing relief for modifications that affect leases, where we have guidance today as to what would be considered a modification of a lease requiring a new contract. We want to be in a position to provide relief from that required assessment. We're also taking a look at providing relief upon the reassessment of embedded derivatives under our existing derivatives guidance. And for other contract modifications, we'd like to have a principle that will allow certain modifications to be considered a continuation of the existing contract and not require consideration of a new contract. Now, the scope as to what this relief would apply, contracts that reference an interest rate that has been discontinued or is anticipated to be discontinued. And part of that language is because we realize there needs to be transition guidance and some hedging situations. There may be two things that need to change, and that may not happen concurrently. And we're talking about contracts for which the changes really relate to the critical term changes that are essential or related exclusively to the replacement of the interest rate and not anything else as it relates to the contractual arrangement. So with those parameters, then that contract could apply for and follow this relief on an optional basis. This is an option. And we also agreed that this could be applied on a topic-by-topic basis. So again, if you're into leases or if you're into loan instruments, you can apply to certain topics, not necessarily all of them, trying to accommodate volumes for different types of institutions. We have a meeting scheduled in July at which we will be talking as a board about additional relief, specifically as it relates to hedge accounting, allowing the hedging relationship to continue without a disruption. So that would be something beyond what I described under our existing guidance, which relates strictly to cash flow hedges. We're also going to talk about disclosures, transition, the expectation, since this is a relief type standard, that there would be a sunset, acknowledging that we're in something of an unusual time frame here. And if everything goes well, and we believe it will, we will probably be on a timetable to issue an exposure draft in the fall. And we're going to continue to monitor the market progress as it relates to SOFR and other rates to hopefully ensure that we're considering everything we need in our language as we develop it.
Andrew?
Thanks. Just to say that we are probably not as advanced in our thinking as EFRAG on the phase two issues, but we thought that their list looked pretty plausible and we would be inclined to support that. It's not to say, and I don't think EFRAG are necessarily suggesting that all of them need standard setting activity, but we think they are probably the main issues that need to be thought about. Just one thought to add is that some institutions will have very large volumes of contracts that need to be examined, and so we would encourage the ISB to think if there is any scope for some kind of practical expedient or something that might make the whole transition a bit less burdensome.
I had a question for Marcia, if I could. In terms of the scope of the relief, in some of the conversations we've had with people in the industry, they've talked about the likelihood that these modifications won't necessarily be value neutral, in the sense that as soon as you've got a contract open for renegotiation, there's always a chance that people are going to either need to incentivize people to make the change or that it's an opportunity to renegotiate terms. Mm-hmm. Did you look at that specifically, or have you dealt with that just by saying narrowly the only thing that can change is the reference to the rate? And does that mean that if there's a change in margins or other things that go on, that means you're outside the scope of the relief and your normal rules apply?
The matter that you've raised is a matter that we're going to discuss in future meetings. So as it relates to primarily, we are talking about changes exclusive to the rate and talking about how to assess the effectiveness going forward.
Thanks. I think that's one of the tricky things we're trying to grapple
with. It is
with.
One of the tricky things, and that's something that we'll continue to deliberate.
Any more comments?
Maybe just a comment. Do you want to comment on what we're doing in terms of the joint boards?
Yes. So they said there will be a joint ISB-FASB meeting on the 23rd of July, and this is one of the topics that is on the agenda. And so both teams will give the boards an update on the project and also the timelines for the next steps. And I know, you know, there's been some fear, I think, that our phase two project might be delayed until next year once we finalized all the amendments to phase one, but I just want to that's not the plan. And so our phase two has already started, and the deliberations will start as well. And so we'll do them concurrently. And part of what we will discuss with the FASB is the scope of issues they are looking at versus the scope of issues that's been flagged to us. And the kind of relief that we could give, given the requirements and our standards, because there are some subtle differences in the standards between the two boards, and so we might not necessarily end up with having exactly the same outcome, although we want to achieve the same objective with the changes. And then also after that, we've got our own board meeting for July, where we will do the feedback summary on the exposure draft, as well as highlight some of the issues that's been flagged by respondents and during our research while the ED was out for comments on issues that could either be resolved in phase one, depending on what solution we do come up with, or have to stand over to phase two. So those issues, we'll have an initial discussion with the board, although we won't be asking them to make any decisions at this meeting because they haven't thought about it yet. But so that's the plan, I think, from our perspective. And then September onwards, we will finalize phase one amendments, and then we'll carry on with the phase two deliberations on the matter as we identify them.
I wanted to ask Linda what were the solutions she had in mind when she said we might manage the transition, the fact, the October deadline.
I have white hairs that my hairdresser's still working on as a result of some of these discussions. But in any event, we're going to have a chat amongst the securities regulators and the audit firms with regard to what their view is going to be in terms of if this is still a moving target. For instance, what positions do entities take in their year-end financial statements, and what disclosures do they need to make about this particular topic in their year-end financial statements, which will have to go out before anything is really settled on this. So that's where we're starting, is the impact in our regulatory environment with regard to the October 31st financial statements. So we're starting there. So that's really where we are, Patrick, no further along than that. Were you looking for something more specific?
No. I think Chiara said it. We in the Union, in the European Union, we have a problem.
Yeah.
If the relief comes too late, it's not okay.
Yeah.
That's really a hurdle in terms of financial information.
Can I just comment on the timing? So obviously, we'll do everything we can on our side to get it done as quickly as possible, which is why we had the shortened comment period and all of those things. But I think one thing that's a little bit unusual about this amendment as opposed to amendments we've had in the past, so say for example if I was to contrast this with the novation amendment we had to do back a few years ago, that was a much more black and white thing, because if you novated and we hadn't done the amendment, you were sort of dead, in the sense there was no way back, because if the novation happened and the amendment, either we hadn't amended the standards or they weren't endorsed, you had something you just couldn't deal with because the standard didn't accommodate it at the time. You just would have had to stop hedge accounting. The situation here is slightly different, and obviously it would all be much easier for everybody if the amendment's done and it's endorsed before people need to worry about it. But people have already been having to make these forward-looking assessments in this period where everybody's sort of knowing LIBOR was going to die already. And so people have already had to get through financial reporting deadlines where they've had to make assessments on whether they can still get comfortable it's highly probable, they can still get comfortable that the effectiveness tests work, et cetera, et cetera. And as I understand it, so far people have got comfortable with that. So even if the amendments weren't done in time or weren't endorsed in time, it then becomes a question of what that then means in terms of how comfortable you are with the judgments you have to make. It's the only point I'm trying to make is a much less black and white situation than in other cases where something's just not allowed and you need the amendment for it to be allowed, whereas here it still would be an open question of whether you can still decide that it's highly probable, et cetera, which is an assessment people have got comfortable with already, knowing all this reform was in the air.
So it's a more nuanced situation. Now, I'm not saying that that means we're not going to hurry up, but I think it's slightly, it's not as bad as we have been, as difficult as in other situations.
May I reply? I think the more time passes, more volumes develop in the new index. Therefore, the same conclusion, we cannot say that we can reach the same conclusion at the year end.
I know that over time it gets more difficult, and we even acknowledge that in the basis of the exposure draft. We say at some point in time, people won't be able to make these assessments, but I'm not sure what point in time that is.